Hey there, it's Shannon Ballard. Before we get to today's episode, I want to say thank you to all of my Southern Mysteries patrons who help make it possible for me to share stories like you'll hear today. Special thanks to my new patrons, Samantha T. from Sumter, South Carolina, Clyde Morris from Round Hill, Kentucky, Lucretia Ward from Concord, North Carolina, and to Sarah Jane Jordan, Adrian, Tina Ditter, Cindy House, AJ, and Corey Lewis, who are all listening and supporting from mysterious locations. Corey shared that they've listened to the show on Spotify for years and would get impatient waiting for new releases and wrote in when they joined on Patreon and said, "I can't wait anymore, so I did what I should have done years ago. It's an honor to be a member of your community." It's an honor to have you here, Corey, and to all of my patrons. Thank you. I hope you enjoy the content you get to hear because you support Southern Mysteries. It's my thanks to you because it's a team effort to keep this show going. If you're new here and you don't know, this is an independent podcast, which is why I rely on support to make this show. And as a thanks, patrons of Southern Mysteries get to hear ad-free episodes and get access to the show archive of the first three seasons, which are only available to patrons. And my much-obliged members get more bonus content, including the archive of previous patron-exclusive episodes and the monthly patron podcast, Audacious, Tales of Scandalous and Shocking Crimes in American History. If you enjoy the show and you want to take the next step and support this independent podcast that is staffed only by me, you can learn more, sign up, and start listening today at patreon.com/southernmysteries. The Battle of Blair Mountain in the summer of 1921 was one of the largest civil uprisings in American history. Violent attacks on Appalachian miners and their families, their dangerous jobs, and the forced debt system in company towns contributed to the conflict. Tension boiled over in 1921 as thousands of Appalachian coal miners revolted against miner union attacks in what would become the largest and bloodiest armed uprising since the Civil War. Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring history and mysteries of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. This is the story of the Battle of Blair Mountain. The Civil War divided the United States and in turn divided the state of Virginia. When Virginia joined the Confederacy in April 1861, the western part of the state opposed secession. This region's loyalty to the Union led its delegates to begin the process of joining the United States. West Virginia was granted statehood in 1863. Long before this new state was formed, this area was central to coal mining. From the mid-1800s on, there was an ever-growing demand for West Virginia coal, with the state's coal fields heating homes and businesses and powering railroads, streetcars, and the growing industry of America. Labor historian Dr. Rachel Donaldson has written about the coal industry and how disorganized and decentralized it was by the end of the 19th century. Mine owners ignored their workers as they were hyper-focused on market competition. In ignoring those miners, they ignored the workers who were generating revenue that made them wealthy. Miners worked under conditions that led to some of the highest recorded fatality rates among industrial workers. They were killed in roof collapses, fires, and explosions due to West Virginia having the weakest mine safety laws in the country. Even if strong laws were on the books, there was no enforcement of safety measures. The miners' safety concerns was a big problem, but so was the debt forced on them in their company town. A majority of West Virginia miners were made to live in company towns to secure their job with the coal company. Since the late 1800s, coal companies in Mingo, Logan, and McDowell counties operated under this system, which exploited coal miners who were making the company rich, while the miners risked their lives for the company. Workers were only paid in company scrip, the currency which was used exclusively within the company town. The company store did offer the option to trade in scrip for U.S. dollars, but it cost workers 25 cents on every dollar they traded. Miners were forced to lease their tools and blasting powder required to do their job. Their cost to lease those tools was taken from their low weekly wage, along with money for the company house the miner lived in, which left them with little to no pay and a growing insurmountable debt. The company town system allowed the coal company to claim they were raising wages and offset that by increasing prices at the company store. The song 16 Tons, released in 1946, spoke of this forced debt system in coal company towns. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. This company town way of life caused tension from its inception. Each time a new miner agreed to take on the job, they learned the price of employment was this system of debt bondage to the coal company. There was a unique shared experience within company towns. At a time when race divided America, with Black Americans and immigrants finding it hard to find fair-paying jobs, coal companies sought out these workers. The coal mines were the only place in America where white and Black Americans, alongside immigrants, were paid the same wage. With limited options for work, these men agreed to work for the coal companies who would treat them equally by tormenting and exploiting them. These miners from different backgrounds and races started to listen to the suggestions of unionizing to gain rights, fair pay, and establish safety measures. In a reminder of the reality of race relations in the 1920s, it would take intense negotiation for labor union leaders, who were all white, to acknowledge and accept Black miners into the union. Eventually, all of these miners would stand shoulder to shoulder to revolt against the coal companies who refused to honor their demands. From the early 1900s until 1921, West Virginia miners who attempted to organize under the United Mine Workers faced resistance and violence. From 1919 through 1921, the epicenter of the mine war's violence was in Mingo, McDowell, and Logan counties, where mine owners and operators forced their workers to sign yellow dog contracts, a personal pledge not to organize or engage in conversation about unionizing. When there were efforts to push back against the company and the town system, agents from the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency were brought in to strike fear in the hearts of miners and their families by harassing miners who called for strikes or tried to organize. They showed no mercy for mining families as they violently evicted men, women, and children from company-owned homes and forced them to live in tents. If a miner organized or joined in a strike, hostilities would rain down on them like they did in the town of Matewan in Mingo County in 1920. That was the year the United Mine Workers began to organize in Mingo County. On May 19th, Baldwin Felts detective agents, acting on orders from Stone Mountain Coal Company, began evicting union miners and their families from company homes in Matewan. Rounds of previous evictions had left hundreds of families homeless, spending the spring of 1920 in tents. Sid Hatfield was the Matewan, West Virginia sheriff, who hailed from the famed Hatfield family and their legendary feud with the McCoys. He bore allegiance to unionized miners in Mingo County rather than the coal companies they worked for. When Sheriff Sid Hatfield and Matewan Mayor Cable Testerman got word Baldwin Felts agents were in the area to evict more families, Hatfield organized a posse to confront the agents near the town train station. The mayor and Hatfield met with detectives on the porch of a hardware store. Based on witness accounts, it was on this porch that Albert Felts fired a shot from his coat pocket, the shot that killed Mayor Testerman. Felts fired again, aiming towards Sid Hatfield, but he killed a miner. Sid Hatfield opened fire to defend himself and killed Albert Felts. When the shooting finally stopped, The town had lost their mayor and two miners. Albert and Lee Feltz, along with five Baldwin Feltz detectives, were also dead. The gunfight, known as the Battle of Mate One, led West Virginia Governor John Cornwell to order martial law in Mingo County, and state police took control. Sheriff Hatfield ordered his men to cooperate with state police. As word spread of what happened in Mate One, miners doubled down on their efforts to organize. The United Mine Workers saw membership grow in Mingo County. And that summer, workers organized a strike. This led coal companies to bring in non-union workers to replace those miners, which resulted in violent resistance from unionized workers. Railroad cars were blown up, and as one Mingo County deputy wrote, "Murder by lying in wait and shooting from ambush has become common." Then came the murder of Sid Hatfield. Hatfield was aware that every agent who worked with Baldwin Feltz was out to kill him to avenge the death of Albert and Lee Feltz. Hatfield was indicted on murder charges after the Battle of Mate One, at which time Hatfield was accused of being the man who fired the shot that killed Mayor Testerman, not Albert Feltz. This called into question everything that happened on that porch. Sid Hatfield's decision to marry the mayor's widow, Jessie Lee, 11 days after the mayor's death, caused a lot of people to ask if he was in love with Jessie Lee and shot the mayor so he could marry his widow. But Jessie Lee testified her husband, Mayor Testerman, was mindful that he was in danger as he stood up to coal companies. According to Jessie Lee, he made her promise that if anything happened to him, she would marry Sid Hatfield, who had agreed to take care of her and her young son. Hatfield, along with 22 miners involved in the Battle of Mate One, were acquitted of all charges on May 19, 1921. 1 month later, Sid Hatfield and his friend Ed Chambers were indicted on conspiracy charges. The charges stemmed from an alleged incident at Mohawk, West Virginia, in which Hatfield and Chambers were accused of forcing miners to unionize. On August 1, 1921, both men were set to face conspiracy charges at the McDowell County Courthouse in Welch. As they walked up the courthouse steps with their wives by their side, several Baldwin Feltz agents shot and killed them. Around 3,000 people honored these fallen heroes of the Appalachian miners' cause when they were laid to rest. Sid Hatfield became a martyr of the movement and inspired thousands of union supporters to organize and prepare to revolt. In the days following Hatfield's murder, miners knew all of the men involved in the cold-blooded murder on those courthouse steps would get away with it. All of the men would be acquitted. As anger rose over Hatfield's murder, miners took up arms and began to organize along the Little Coal River to patrol and guard the area. Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin sent officers to that area, but the miners outsmarted them, captured and disarmed them, and sent them home. On August 7, 1921, United Mine Worker organizers Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney met with West Virginia Governor Morgan in Charleston. They made seven demands to bring about peace, including the establishment of an eight-hour workday, increased safety for workers, and the end of discrimination against employees who belong to labor unions. The governor rejected them all. Keeney and Mooney vowed to march to Mingo County and take on the coal companies who had established martial law and taken union miners into custody. They boldly proclaimed they would take back southern coal fields in Mingo and Logan County, but their only obstacle was Blair Mountain. Blair Mountain was situated in the way of Logan and Mingo County, which meant miners had to make it over the mountain to take back control of the counties. This meant defeating Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin, a fierce opponent of unionization. After Chafin became sheriff, he was known as the boss of Logan County. Chafin allegedly controlled every judge and jury in the county. His power was noticed by mine operators who made generous payments to Chafin in exchange for his commitment to keep unions out of Logan County. The bribes paid to Chafin came in the form of large cash payments, along with the coverage of expenses of the sheriff's department. The bribes were estimated to be at least $40,000 a year. If they suspected an organizer was in their county, the deputies forced the man to leave or beat him until he changed his mind. Sheriff Chafin declared to his men that no armed mob would cross Logan County and told his troopers to be prepared to stop miners as they made their attempt to cross Blair Mountain. By August 24th, it's estimated around 5,000 miners organized and gathered just 2 miles outside of Logan County. Sheriff Chafin organized his defenses along the base of Blair Mountain, preparing his troops for battle. The sheriff's commitment to coal companies was rewarded when Logan County coal operators ordered a private armed force of 2,000 men to the county to support Chafin's troopers and help them hold back the miners. Early on August 25th, there were a few skirmishes at the base of Blair Mountain. But those small conflicts and the armed forces gathered around led President Warren Harding to declare he would send federal troops and army bombers to end the fighting if the conflict did not end. The miners began to pull back because their battle was with the coal companies, not the U.S. government. Just hours after the miners began to retreat, one of Sheriff Chafin's troopers fired at a union sympathizer, and innocent families were caught in the middle of that gunfire. The miners ended their retreat and turned back to fight. Up until this point, there had been little national coverage of the uprising and the gathering of these opposing forces near Blair Mountain. Local papers had staff working around the clock to cover every angle of the story. Not only the coal companies and the miners, but the civilians who lived in the area and were directly impacted by fighting and violence. By August 28th, an estimated 10,000 Union miners and their supporters had gathered near the Logan County border, occasionally engaging in gunfights with the company supporters and Chafin's troops. The miners soon realized they had to work out a way to distinguish one side from the other in the dense woods. A large number of miners dubbed themselves the Redneck Army and tied red handkerchiefs around their necks, ensuring fellow miners knew they were allies. By August 29th, the Battle of Blair Mountain saw Sheriff Chafin's men outnumbered by miners, but the sheriff had better weapons. Chafin's troops made homemade bombs and used private planes to drop them on the miners. The violence escalated when Chafin's troops gained access to poisonous gas and bombs left over from World War I and dropped them on 3 towns near Blair Mountain. Civilians in this region were constantly at risk as the battle raged on in the hills and hollers around Blair Mountain. One miner described the sound like this: machine guns cracked up there so you would think the whole place was coming down on you. And occasionally you realized you were hearing the sounds of cracking bombs. When West Virginia Governor Morgan called in the state National Guard to oppose the miners on August 30th, national newspapers began to cover the uprising at Blair Mountain. By order of President Harding, federal troops moved in with an Army Air Service Reconnaissance Squadron, flying patrols over the region on September 1st. The next day, over 2,000 federal troops arrived. There were some short gunfights for the next few days, but miners refused to engage with federal troops. A majority of these miners were veterans. They would not aim their gun at a federal force because they were not the enemy of Appalachian coal miners. Around 1,000 miners surrendered to the Army as the rest retreated to return home, knowing they would face arrest as federal troops were sent in to help coal companies. Eventually, the state charged 925 miners with murder, conspiracy to commit murder, accessory to murder, and treason against the state. Many of those miners spent time in prison, but a majority were acquitted by juries who were sympathetic to their actions and what happened at Blair Mountain. The coverage of the Battle of Blair Mountain was as divided as the miners and the coal companies. National papers wrote of wild rebels who fought law enforcement, but left out the part about law enforcement being employed by coal companies who were terrorizing miners and their families. Local papers covered the story in its entirety, explaining why miners felt endangered and threatened to the point they were willing to go to battle for unionization. Those miners were defeated at Blair Mountain, and so was the United Mine Workers of America. The unionized miners who were arrested were defended by United Mine Workers attorneys, and one of the costliest defenses was for union organizers Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney. They were charged with treason, but later acquitted. The legal fees hurt union organizing efforts and drove the United Mine Workers to the point of bankruptcy. By October 1921, coal owners petitioned the U.S. government to destroy miners' unions. On October 28th, mine owners rejected a proposed peace plan from labor unions, and the unions fell out of favor in West Virginia, a trend that would continue throughout the decade to come. Labor unions began to lose union members and influence. Around 1920, the United Mine Workers had around 5 million members. By 1930, membership dropped to less than 2 million. But labor unions bounced back in the 1930s due to the pro-union stance of the Roosevelt administration. Legislation like the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 provided for collective bargaining. And by 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It required businesses to enter into good faith bargaining with any union supported by the majority of their employees. The Battle of Blair Mountain is an important chapter in labor history. Due to a lack of confirmed reports, we'll never know the exact numbers of those killed and wounded in battle. It's been estimated that some 1 million rounds of ammunition were fired during the Battle of Blair Mountain, with 20 to 100 casualties. Charles Keeney is the great-grandson of mine workers' union leader, Frank Keeney. He's an author and history professor who has written extensively of West Virginia's attempt to erase this chapter from history books. In fact, Keeney writes of the mine wars being deliberately written out of textbooks in West Virginia, just as journalists attempting to travel through the region during the battle to tell the story of what was happening on the ground were censored and told to go home. He led the Friends of Blair Mountain in an effort to get the Battle of Blair Mountain battlefield back on the National Register. In 2009, the National Park Service added Blair Mountain to the National Register of Historic Places. But by the end of the year, the decision was reversed due to a dispute over property ownership. The Friends of Blair Mountain fought back. They filed a lawsuit to protect the battlefield site from planned surface mining by two coal companies who had permits for the area. In June 2018, the National Register reversed their reversal and relisted the Blair Mountain battlefield site, noting in the listing it was to honor the brave Appalachian miners who fought for fair and safe working conditions. In May 2015, the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum opened in Mate 1. The museum is situated at the site of the historic 1920 Battle of Mate 1, which would ultimately set off a chain of events which culminated in the Battle of Blair Mountain. The West Virginia Mine Wars Museum works to share the legacy of human rights and justice in labor for working people in Appalachia and around the world. You can learn more about the museum and their mission at wvminewars.org. A final note about the Battle of Blair Mountain and rednecks. The Redneck Army is often referred to as the point at which the term redneck became popular. But that's not true. The word redneck has been around since the 1800s. Depending on where you lived and whether you were politically active, it had different meanings. Some use the word as a derogatory reference to white farmers whose necks would burn as they worked in their fields. It had a religious connotation for white Presbyterians in North Carolina who were known as rednecks. Workers who were part of an 1877 railroad strike in West Virginia wore those red bandanas, which symbolized solidarity and continued to serve that purpose for labor movements and activists. It's just a reminder, even a word can have a very complicated history. If you want to dive deeper into the history of the Mind Wars, I recommend two books that were sources for this episode. On Dark and Bloody Ground by Anne Lawrence is the first. In 1972, Anne went to West Virginia, interviewed people who participated in or witnessed the Battle of Blair Mountain. On Dark and Bloody Ground includes the only set of oral histories about the Mine Wars of the 20s and 30s. I'd also encourage you to check out The Road to Blair Mountain by Charles Keeney, which details his nine-year battle to return the Blair Mountain Battlefield site to the National Register of Historic Places. I'll drop links to both of those books in the full show notes, which are, as always, available at southernmysteries.com. And keep in mind, you can follow me on Instagram at Explore the South for show updates and more. And if you're so inclined, I'd love it if you would take the time to follow the show so you'll get new episodes in your feed and rate and review Southern Mysteries to help encourage others to check it out. Thanks for doing that. And as always, thanks for listening.